This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear from Kalamazoo native Ben Lando, the founder and editor-in-chief of the online news site Iraq Oil Report. We'll discuss the explosion of sectarian violence in Iraq. But first, Congressman Justin Amash is seeking his third term in the U.S. House. He represents both Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in the 3rd District. He faces a primary challenge this year from businessman Brian Ellis. Justin Amash joins us at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
And we're also joined today by Battle Creek Inquirer reporter Jennifer Bowman.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Amash, why don't you begin by briefly telling the audience a little bit more about yourself in case they don't know, and what you'd like to do if you had another 2 years in the U.S. House.
Sure. I was born in Grand Rapids, have lived in West Michigan pretty much all my life. I attended the University of Michigan, so that was really the only time I was outside of the West Michigan area for a very long period. My parents are immigrants. I am part of the first generation of my family to be born in this country. When I was a kid, my dad really instilled in us a sense of appreciation for the American way of life, for our system of government, for the fact that anyone can come here and succeed and provide for their family. My dad was a refugee, so he had a tough time growing up. And I went to Michigan Law and became a lawyer. And while serving as a lawyer, I decided that it was important I step up and do something to protect the way of life that our founders put in place and that my dad struggled to provide for our family by bringing his family here when he was just a kid. And so I ran for the state house, served in the state house for one term, started to explain every vote I took on Facebook, and thought that that kind of transparency and accountability would be helpful in Congress. So when the seat opened up for the 3rd Congressional District, I ran for Congress and won that race, and I've never missed a vote. I explain every single vote I take using Facebook at facebook.com/RepJustinAmash. And I follow the Constitution and believe in limited government, economic freedom, and individual liberty. And for me, it's not about being a Republican or a Democrat. It's about doing what's right for ordinary Americans. And that's really been my focus as a congressman.
Jennifer Bowman, first question for Justin Amash.
I want to start with a recent editorial by the Grand Rapids Press. It criticized your declining to debate with Brian Ellis. Is there any concern if you decline to debate that it may dissuade undecided voters? Or, you know, when can you determine that your opponent is a credible candidate?
Well, we've seen the kind of race my opponent is running. It's been a smear campaign for about 8 or 9 months. There's been no effort on his part to actually present any ideas or issues. He's just been distorting my record. And I have worked hard as a congressman to be as transparent and open as possible. So my record has been an open book. I'm the only congressman in the history of the country who has explained every single vote he's taken. That actually takes a lot of effort, a lot of work, but I think it's very important that our constituents know how we're voting and why we're voting. So I stand behind my record. I know that my constituents have access to it. They can see every single vote. And I hold a lot of town halls, more town halls than the rest of the Michigan congressional delegation. And my town halls are always open to the public. I don't screen any questions. We don't take questions on note cards. People can come to the town hall and raise their hands and ask anything. And certainly if Brian Ellis had any concerns over the past few years, he could have come to any town hall and asked me any question, and I would have been happy to answer. But he's not really interested in that kind of discussion. He's interested in a smear campaign. And if you hold a debate with him, he's just going to continue with his talking points. And you are really beholden to how the media presents the debate, because it's not going to be widely viewed. It's not like a presidential debate where everyone's going to see it and see the differences between us and see whether the questions were fair or whether both sides presented issues. It's going to be a small story in the newspaper or just a brief coverage on Wood or WWMT.
When you say smear campaign and distorting your record, give some specific examples of things that he has said that are counter to your actual record in Congress.
Sure. For example, he attacks me on pro-life issues. I'm 100% pro-life. And he has taken one vote from last term out of context and tried to present it in a way that is not an accurate representation of my position. He attempts to allege that I'm in favor of something horrific, sex selection abortions. Obviously, I don't favor any abortions, and I'm 100% pro-life. And to do that is really despicable, in my opinion.
But Right to Life of Michigan also endorsed Brian Ellis in part because of that vote. So can you explain a little bit more about why you did not vote explicitly for that bill, which would have banned abortion for sex selection?
Yeah, and I voted on many pieces of legislation to restrict abortion. I believe that life is important from conception. And on that particular vote, they inserted language into the bill that would have put a doctor, nurse, counselor in prison for failing to report that that person suspects that another doctor has performed an abortion. And that's a crime of inaction. It's a thought crime. And in this country, we don't put people in prison because they didn't do something. We put people in prison when they actually commit the crime themselves. So I'm 100% pro-life, but I would never put an innocent person in prison because they overheard at some event that maybe another doctor had performed an abortion and they didn't report it to authorities.
Jennifer.
Ellis has criticized your efforts in reforming NSA practices, something actually that you've received bipartisan support for. But in his latest ad, I'm sure you're aware, you've been called Al-Qaeda's best friend. His criticism is that your reform prevents monitoring of terrorist activity in other countries. Any concern? Is that a fair criticism?
The ad is despicable, and I don't think he's getting anywhere with it. He's actually pushing something that nobody else in the country is pushing, which is a reauthorization of the Patriot Act with no reforms. The vote he cites in that ad is a vote that I took against reauthorizing the Patriot Act. Well, the NSA has used the Patriot Act to spy on ordinary Americans. So when he's talking about monitoring foreign terrorists, he's just using that as a broad overview of what the Patriot Act was supposed to do, when in fact it's being used to monitor ordinary Americans. So unless he considers ordinary Americans to be foreign terrorists, his ad is deceptive and frankly quite disgusting. If you ask people at home, do they support what the NSA is doing, the vast majority on both sides of the aisle will say no, they do not, especially on the Republican side, frankly. So he's trying to cover it with language of terrorism and all the rest. But what he's really saying is that he supports NSA spying on ordinary Americans because that's what the vote was about, and I voted to stop that.
Under what conditions should Congress authorize the use of force in foreign countries?
The only situation would be if the United States or our interests are in imminent danger. There might be rare occasions where there is an attempt by one country to commit mass genocide against a people who are totally defenseless, and there's not sort of equivalent force on both sides in which the United States or other countries may have to step up. But in those cases, it must be, and in all cases, it must be authorized by Congress. You can't have the president insert our military into foreign conflicts without congressional authorization. But in most foreign civil wars where you don't have a huge disparity, where it's not just a clear attempt at genocide, the United States should not enter into those conflicts because it's not really in our interest.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're speaking with Congressman Justin Amashi, seeking his third term in the U.S. House, representing Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. We are speaking at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek, and Battle Creek Inquirer reporter Jennifer Bowman is here as well. Jennifer.
Some have described this primary as, you know, the traditional Republican candidate versus a libertarian leaning. Your opponent, Brian Ellis, has said, well, I don't necessarily think I'm out to get to another party. And he argues that he shares many of the same values as the Tea Party. Do you think that's a fair characterization of the race? Or
I don't think the Tea Party agrees with that assessment of his own candidacy. I won't speak for people in the Tea Party, but I would tell you that he has very little support among conservatives and among Tea Party people. Mainstream Republicans hold my views. He's not a traditional Republican in any real sense of the word. What he is a political class, sort of Washington establishment candidate. It's almost without a party. And the kind of things I'm pushing for, limited government, economic freedom, individual liberty, are the hallmarks of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party has strayed from those principles for many years, but increasingly it is moving back in that direction. And when I go to town halls, overwhelmingly Republicans agree with my positions and agree with my view of government. I feel very comfortable as a Republican and feel that mainstream Republicans hold my views and would oppose his views. I mean, he supports Common Core. He supports Obamacare expansion in Michigan through Medicaid expansion. He supports corporate welfare. He supports NSA spying on Americans. These are not positions that most Republicans hold. If you polled those positions, they would probably get less than 10% approval among Republicans.
Do you see this race as being about the direction of the Republican Party going forward?
Yes. And Brian Ellis has already lost, and the establishment have already lost this race.
How so?
Well, first, I'm confident we'll win by a large margin on Election Day. But mainstream Republicans don't agree with people like Brian Ellis. Mainstream Americans don't agree with people like Brian Ellis. If you look at the attacks, his distortions, his attacks during the campaign, he is attacking me for holding mainstream positions. And the bottom line is they've already lost. That's why over and over, what you're seeing is establishment candidates in Congress who are actually having tougher and tougher elections. You saw Eric Cantor lose his race while outspending his opponent by a crazy amount. It might have been 20-1. And he still lost that race because their views don't represent ordinary Americans. Regular people want to feel represented in Congress. They don't want members of Congress, certainly members of the Republican Party, representing just special interests, corporate interests, Wall Street, people who have connections, wealthy people. And that's the group that Brian Ellis really comes from and really wants to represent. I mean, his criticisms against me have been that I'm too independent and that I represent regular people.
Now, you say you're confident you're going to win. I'm sure Eric Cantor was pretty confident he was going to win as well. If there is a surprise in early August in your defeat in the Republican primary, what does that say about the direction of the party going forward?
Well, I don't think it's possible. But it would be a bad omen for the party. The reason I'm confident is because I know Republican voters. I know ordinary Americans. I spend a lot of time in the district talking to people. All you have to do is walk around and ask about issues, and you can figure out where people are. And Republicans don't support his ideas. As I said, the establishment has already lost. Their numbers are dwindling. They're basically on the run, and a lot of them are retiring. And in no time, you'll have more independent-minded, more liberty-minded Republicans who care about civil liberties, who want to fight corporate welfare and want to stand up for ordinary Americans leading the party.
Congressman Justin Amash, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Justin Amash is seeking his third term in the U.S. House, representing Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in the 3rd District. We've been speaking to him today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. And thanks again to Battle Creek Inquirer reporter Jennifer Bowman.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
WMUK has invited candidates in contested primaries for Congress and the state legislature in Southwest Michigan to be interviewed ahead of the August primary.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. For the past several weeks, Iraq has been back in the headlines. Insurgents with the group known as ISIS have advanced in various parts of the nation. That has caused debate in the United States over what role, if any, the U.S. should take in Iraq. One person who has recently had a close-up view of the situation is Ben Lando, the Kalamazoo native whose previous experience includes reporting for WMUK, is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Iraq Oil Report. Ben Lando, thank you for being here again.
Hey, thanks a lot.
How different is what's going on now in Iraq with ISIS from, say, Al-Qaeda in Iraq or any of the other various sectarian violence which has taken place there over the years?
Well, in many ways, it's an evolution of the violence that has taken place since 2003. It was, in many ways, a new kind of violence that kept coming back up and had various, you know, motivations. But what's happened in the past, you know, 3 weeks after, you know, insurgents overran Mosul, which was a key point in Iraqi history now, and that's continuing to play out. You know, we've seen both the strength of this new, somewhat new group, and we've seen the inability of the Iraqi government to combat it. And it's really taken the terrorism in Iraq to a whole new level. Before this, you know, we've seen Al-Qaeda come essentially since 2003. There's almost no evidence, and there was very, very little activity of like proper Al-Qaeda working in Iraq before 2003. But after that, after the fall of Saddam Hussein and a number of other administrative decisions like disbanding the army, that created this breeding ground for people who wanted or were willing to engage in violence against the state, whether it was for money, whether it was for revolution, or some sort of religious or spiritual calling, if we can name it that. And that grew and grew. And even though there was, and it grew simultaneously with other, you know, terrorist organizations as they were evolving in both in the region but globally. And so we saw these groups that had given themselves a lot of sway in Iraq through, you know, 2007 to 2008 suddenly being suppressed organically almost. Part of it was the surge of U.S. troops, but most of that was the Iraqi government and Iraqi leadership convincing the folks who were allied with Al-Qaeda to turn against them, that being part of the state is going to be more beneficial to you and your people and the people you represent than a terrorist group which is actively giving you money but is inciting violence in your country. And so terrorism never went away. Bombs still continued. But during this time, there wasn't this big insurgent. There was a time for, especially after the 2010 elections, there's a time for a real Iraqi unity where now marginalized groups felt that they had an opportunity to be brought back into the fold and have a role in their government. During this time, though, 2010, when there was this opportunity in Iraq, that's when the start of, you know, the Arab Spring, which kind of catapulted in 2011 and 2012, really gave this new group, the Islamic State, an opportunity to gather weapons and money and forces and really start to create a vision for themselves that saw actually establishing a new entity, a new state, a new government. And that was bred in Iraq initially, and then in Syria, it's where it got its training. That was the almost like a boot camp. And then largely after they took Fallujah in January of this year, they showed their massive presence in Iraq with what happened in Mosul a few weeks ago. Although there was constant presence of what is now the Islamic State in Iraq over the past few years, including mass bombings, and they broke out people from jails in prisons who are now, their top commanders in this war.
Now, you described that there's an evolution with a lot of various parts going on. So
Is the perception that some people might have in the United States then faulty, that this sort of just sprung up out of nowhere? Was this something that gradually came to be in Iraq?
Absolutely. This is definitely the incident, you know, the date that it took place was surprising to many people, although not those who were deeply inside the kind of the intelligence sector in Iraq. But this was brewing both on the side of the Islamic State organization, but also, you know, we had a community in Iraq that spans at least a third of the country from the, you know, the massive border with Syria all the way to the border with Iran. That is a group of people who are feeling that after 2003, they were sent back to their homes and told to essentially bow down to the new leadership of Iraq. They were then brought back into the fold with this hope of having a role in the country, and then marginalized and oppressed again, including with some pretty brutal tactics of mass incarcerations, jailing, and sometimes even executions without a fair trial or even a trial with any evidence at all. To be sure, there were some bad things happening, and the identity of these people committing bad things happened to be Sunni Muslim in Iraq. But the Sunni Muslim community as a whole was being punished. And that led to the opportunities for, whether it was the Islamic State or tribal groups or various more homegrown militias or former Saddam Hussein allies or even just former Iraqi army, you know, senior officials to form what's now a collection of various different groups. So it's not just one organization, although, you know, the Islamic State or ISIS is being, at least in some places, just consider the tip of the spear, and in some areas are actually trying to hold territory. And now with this declaration of an Islamic State, the caliphate itself is trying to hold territory. None of this happened overnight. This happened through years of training and fundraising and collaboration.
So when you're in Iraq for a long period of time, relatively speaking, longer than many people spend there, what sort of things are you seeing that perhaps don't make it into regular news coverage, may make it into a deep dive sort of story. But if people are just sort of catching up with the evening news, what sort of things do you think they're not hearing about what's happening in Iraq right now, especially for people just, you know, kind of in day-to-day life?
Well, day-to-day life has stalled in many places, less so in the Kurdistan region, which has been able to prosper a lot quicker than other parts of Iraq, and less so in furthest south in Basra. But people are not out on the streets. People are not out in public as much as they were before. People aren't at ice cream shops because those are now being bombed more frequently or had been. There's this feeling that these unresolved sectarian issues, the absent reconciliation process that was promised, is now turning into a highly sectarian, highly fractured country that is any efforts to address that gap is seen as dangerous for those who would attempt to do that. So it's forced people, whether, you know, the main groups, you know, Shia Muslim, Sunni Muslim, Kurdish, to retract back into that safety net of community. You know, the sectarian killings are happening again, and access to services, which is already troubling, has started to dwindle. You know, there's long lines for gasoline again, and a lot of people gouging and increasing the prices. You know, I think one thing when you're in Iraq and then you read or watch really more mainstream news shows about this, especially TV. You know, you see this debate over like whether the U.S. should have withdrawn or should they have kept forces there, and you know, who's to blame and what's the way out of this. And I think what's not being understood is that everyone's to blame, and there's no easy way, if a way, out of this at all. And that that takes a big look in the mirror to be able to say that, I guess.
What is the feeling that you get when you talk to Iraqis of a certain age here, and let's, you know, say 40 or younger, because in their lifetime, they have probably all they remember is either being under the rule of Saddam Hussein, sanctions against Iraq, the U.S.-led war in Iraq, the aftermath of that, and now ISIS. I mean, that's 40 years of some very troubled times in that country. And I wonder if you get a sense of, does that make people resilient, or does it sometimes make people feel somewhat hopeless?
From what I've seen, it's a combination, and it really depends on the day or the hour of the events. I mean, not only has it been year after year, from coup to dictatorship to war, 8-year war with Iran to war with Kuwait, sanctions, bombings during sanctions, and essential starvation, both food and medicine and other essentials from the country. Then the 2003 invasion and shock and awe, and then the occupation, which has further destabilized and in many ways crippled the institutions of the state, followed by mostly inept leadership, and then a surge by the Islamic State. And all throughout this, on a lower level, but more meaningful level, I mean, that's, you're taking away generations of people necessary for any state to develop itself to grow itself and to forward itself. So you take that away, and then you have what's left, the people who are left to live in this situation. And it's the fact that they can wake up every day and crack a joke and have invite people over to have a meal. I mean, that speaks volumes for itself. But it also is maybe another classic Iraqi trait of just accepting the inevitability and just saying, whatever happens, happens. Today is today.
The last time you were here, we talked about your ability to report accurately what's going on in Iraq while still being safe. And I wonder how much tougher that has become over the last month.
It's extremely tough. We're definitely making decisions on reporting, especially, I mean, not just the foreign staff, the expat staff, but the Iraqi staff. There's definitely decisions that we have to make on how to cover a story. A few months ago, April, I think it was, March maybe, and the insurgents had taken over Fallujah and repelled any attempts for the government to come back into Fallujah. And they ended up taking over the Fallujah Dam, which is a main venue through which water from the Euphrates comes into southern Iraq. I mean, it impacts all of mid and all of southern Iraq. And so, I said, this is really interesting. I asked our reporter in Fallujah to find out, just understanding exactly what kind of impact this makes to agriculture. Could it anger people? How could it be used as a weapon? Water as a weapon to flooding certain areas or keeping certain areas without water. And so we got the report back, and our reporter is, explaining how he went and just approached these guys at the dam, and they're wearing, Afghan style clothing, and they had their phones taken for a while, and there's a chance that they wouldn't make it out. And then they had this interview with a guy who wouldn't give his first name, but you read it, and it was a good report, and we ran excellent story on that. And then you had to sit back and say, okay, don't do that again. Like, we don't want you to go. We don't need you to go do that. And that causes some question as to how well anyone can cover the story in Iraq. But I guess for us, over time, as we built up contacts and sources and reporters, that's helped us. I mean, since we've been there the whole time, it's helped us kind of maintain our coverage safely and not having to reduce as much as possible, putting our people, in difficult and dangerous situations.
Ben Lando, as always, thank you very much for your time. And please be safe when you head back to Iraq.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Ben Lando is a Kalamazoo native. He is also the founder and editor-in-chief of the Iraq Oil Report. Links with more information and longer versions of the interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.